The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In-your-face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we will be talking with the 10th Commissioner of Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred. But before we get started with Rob, we'd like to tell you about our great sponsor, Gillette. Gillette has been part of my day for as long as I can remember. A truly great brand. There was never anything else or anything close. My dad used it. I use it. My sons use it. You know what you're getting each time you use it, and that's a great shave. The high-quality craftsmanship of the blade is perfect, and I'm even a big fan of the Fusion Gel Cream. Used it this morning. My friends at Gillette have great news to share that makes it an even better experience. You can now get Gillette Performance delivered right to your door. Subscribe today and get every fourth order free. Check out Gillette online at www.gilletteondemand.com. Welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast, sponsored by Gillette and Geico. And on the Gillette hotline this morning is the 10th Commissioner of Baseball, Rob Manfred. And every time I say that to Rob, and I refer to him as the 10th, it occurs to me how few people have ever held this job. And he succeeded Bud Selig. We will talk about this today. At a point where I think this sport is in the midst of a great renaissance, particularly because of unprecedented young talent. And it just seems to me, as we get closer to spring training, it's a good time to do this. So good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Mike. How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm like somebody lined up outside a concert like a week in advance, because I'm already in Florida waiting for pitchers and catchers to report. But we're having this conversation on the morning of the night when the new inductees to the National Baseball Hall of Fame will be announced. And Rob, let me begin the conversation by saying this. It is extraordinary to me every single year that this touches off such emotion and debate, and it speaks to the power of baseball, because it's not like this with the Hall of Fame announcements in other sports.
Mike, I couldn't agree with you more. Sometimes you think about it and you say, gee, you know, people are talking about controversial issues, about how you should think about players who played during particular eras. But then you realize that the more important point is they're talking about it and they really deeply, deeply care about it. And, you know, that's not true of every other Hall of Fame.
Rob, you know, every year the principal debate evolves, the so-called steroid era, and Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and others who have been attached to this subject. And from where you sit, and obviously the decisions about who's eligible and who's not and who gets in involve the voters and the Hall of Fame itself. Is there any good answer or any good solution to the debate about players who were great in this particular era but who are attached to performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, I think that the difficulty with coming up with a solution is that, you know, like often is the case with players on different topics, none of these cases are exactly the same. You know, is the guy that people suspect the same as the guy who tested positive? Is the guy who tested positive the same as the guy who was named in the Mitchell report? And so it makes it very difficult to come up with a single solution. I actually do believe it's one of those issues where we have to trust the writers over, you know, literally decades. They've done a pretty good job sorting through issues that surround particular players. And I think that they will do that with respect to this issue.
Talking to Rob Manfred, the 10th Commissioner of Baseball, on the Mike Lupica Podcast. And, you know, I talk about this subject a lot with my friend and your friend, Bob Costas. And you know, B- Bob has made it clear that if he had a vote, he would vote for Bonds and Clemens. And he's even jokingly suggested that there could even someday be a wing of the Hall of Fame that explains all of this with certain candidates who may or may, you know, who finally will get in and say, okay, here's what they did on the field. Here's what they were accused of off the field. And, you know, I know the 10th commissioner of baseball wouldn't say this. I said we could have a dirtbag wing of the Hall of Fame. You know, and Rob, it's kind of dark and the air conditioning is bad and the lighting's right. Not great, but there you would find these plaques. But can you ever see yourself having an official position, offering your own opinions about this to the voters?
No, I really can't, Mike. I think that in different contexts, we have had internal conversations about this topic, and I think where we come down is that one of the reasons that the National Baseball Hall of Fame is different than the Hall of Fames in other sports is its independence and the fact that the election to the Hall of Fame has been committed to a neutral body, that is the writers. And it's just not appropriate for someone in my position to try to influence those writers.
We're talking to Rob Manfred, the 10th Commissioner of Baseball, on the Mike Lupica podcast. If there is one thing that has been made clear about you just in your time in this job is you're not a grudge holder. And to me, the greatest example of that is the way Alex Rodriguez has been, I don't want to say allowed, Rob, been able to rehabilitate himself to the point where it's just been announced that he's going to be on Sunday Night Baseball. He's been working with Fox. And since we're talking about performance-enhancing drugs, if somebody had told you a few years ago, during the heat of Biogenesis, that when he was in the barrel on that, that this would happen a few years later, we would have, but Rob, we would have had that person drug tested.
Well, you know, look, I would say this. First and most important, the person that deserves the credit for the success that Alex has achieved since he left the game is Alex. You know, he worked really hard on his reentry to the game and has worked really hard on his career afterwards. We have tried to be helpful to Alex. He and I have had conversations. He's had conversations with members of my staff, both about returning to the game and about his career in broadcasting. And, you know, that is a product of my belief that we negotiated the toughest, and I really do believe that drug testing program in all of sport, not just professional sports, and the penalties in that program are the penalties. After you serve your penalty, I think people are entitled to try to go on with their careers and their lives, and we've tried to be good to that bargain.
We're talking to Rob Manfred. By the way, you know, when I was getting ready to do this today, and in full disclosure, the commissioner and I come from the same part of the world in upstate New York, and we could probably find a tortured way to say that we're actually related. Can you believe that we are sitting on the third anniversary of, has it possibly been 3 years since you took this job?
You know, it is amazing. It has been a really, really quick 3 years.
Oh man. Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, I do think that we've accomplished some really important things. I'm actually on my way to Washington today to speak to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, who's been a great partner to us on our Play Ball initiative. We've made real progress in terms of youth participation. As you pointed out, I think we have done a nice job capitalizing on an amazing influx of young talent into the game. By the same token, there's a lot left to do. When you think that 3 years have gone by this fast, my overwhelming thought is I need to get on my horse and make sure we keep after the issues that are important to us.
Okay, that leads me to something I actually wanted to get to later, but the whole pace of play thing, and I'm trying to follow this from the outside. Obviously, you're on the inside. The union is on the inside. Rob, what possible objection would the union have to taking all sensible steps to do the one thing that all of us who love this game want it to do, which is to speed up?
Yeah, you know, Mike, this is an interesting topic. I think if you read some of the comments from players on this topic publicly, they reflect a genuine realization that we need to do something about the issue of pace of play. You know, it's not just a baseball thing. You think about it, you know, football's thinking about the issue, basketball's thinking about the issue, which is a product of how our society is. All institutions in our society need to be responsive to the fact that, you know, we live in a very fast-paced, short attention span society. I think the rub comes when you get into the specifics. And, you know, this player or that player feels that whatever the particular change is going to affect his routine on the field, could impact his performance, might change the game. I mean, I think the best summary of it, you know, Jim Deshaies, another good upstate New York guy, said to me during we were talking about this issue during a Cubs broadcast earlier this year. He said, you know, he says your difficulty on pace of game is that you have to talk to the one group that is least inclined to change anything, and that's Major League players. And the reason for that is, you know, they've achieved their goal, and each and every one of them is concerned that any change could have an impact on their career.
Rob, when you look down the road, when you look down the road in baseball, is there a possibility in 2 or 3 years, or perhaps even sooner than that, that we would not only have a pitch clock, but we would have eliminated trips to the mound by coaches and managers and catchers in this sport?
Well, look, I think a pitch clock is a real possibility. You know, we have the right to do it this year unilaterally. I've said repeatedly that I prefer to proceed by agreement, but I think the pitch clock has to remain out there as something that will be in our sport in the relatively near future. Mound visits, I see it more. I mean, the way I see mound visits going is more like an evolution into timeouts. They're not going to be eliminated altogether, but there's going to be a restriction on the number of times it can happen in a game.
Yeah, because you know this, I know this, everybody, and again, baseball's my first love, it's your first love. How many of us don't just sigh and put our chins on our chest when we see the catcher putting his hand up and making his third trip to the mound in a particular half inning?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's just, and I don't mean to suggest that players in their mind when they do it don't believe they have a good competitive reason to do it. But the fact of the matter is the purpose of many of the rules we have on the playing field is to restrict those competitive instincts in a way that makes the game a saleable entertainment product. So, I think it's just something that we're going to have to bite into. And, you know, we have some of the greatest athletes in the world playing our game, and they're going to adjust.
Rob, there's one thing that I think about, and I want to run this by you, and it's a longer, broader conversation, but I'll try to bumper sticker it, and it is this. Are you ever uncomfortable with the notion that because of the dominance of some bullpens now in this sport, that there is a less than subliminal message being sent out that if your team gets the lead in the sixth inning, the game might be over, when in other sports, we're looking forward to the fourth quarter. We're looking forward to the third period of a hockey game in which anything could happen. And I have all respect for the way managers manage the bullpen. I see what's happened over the last 30 years. My friend Bob Ryan calls it the creeping LaRussaism of baseball. Lefty, righty, matchups, this and that. But isn't there a message being sent that if it's 4-2 or 5-2 in the sixth inning, that if you got a good bullpen, the game's over?
You know, you make a great point about sort of a larger topic. You know, pace of game is one issue related to the changes in the way the game is being played over the last few decades and how those changes have affected the entertainment value of the product. And interestingly, I think if you talk to players, and I know if you talk to people, owners, and on the management side of the game, people are concerned about the changes in the way the game has been played. And I think hopefully we're going to get a resolution on the pace of game issue, and that's kind of going to be step one. But I think, and I've expressed this to Tony Clark, and I think he agrees, that we need to have a broader conversation about managing the way that the game is being played. And I want to be really careful about it, because as you know, the traditionalists in our game get all uneasy when you talk about the game. I'm not talking about a conversation that involves changing the game. The game is changing, has been changing by itself. And the question is, should we be more proactive in managing that change?
Where do you weigh in on the shifts? Because you get passionate baseball fans in a room, and I'm talking about reasonable and intelligent and non-crazed baseball fans. And if you've got 10 people in the room, Rob, they'll divide up equally about whether they think the shifts are good or bad for baseball.
Yeah, look, I mean, I understand that shifts are a product of people applying, you know, quantitative analysis to make decisions about how to win more games. And, you know, I get that. In fact, in, you know, my own little world, I am a quantitative decision maker. I like data.
Oh, really? I'd never picked up on that. Really? No kidding.
Right. I am. But look, when it comes to watching a game, I must confess to you, I prefer to see the players in their natural position. And I think that the shifts are part of a number of developments in the game that we need to have a conversation about, think hard about, and decide whether they are good for our game over the long haul.
Talking to Rob Mann for the 10th Commissioner of Baseball. I've got a limited amount of time with him today, and I got a lot to get to. And I don't want to go back and relitigate the interview that you did with Dan Le Batard. But it seemed to me, in reading the transcript, is that the kerfuffle in that thing was that you were being accused of knowing exactly what the Marlins planned to do when the team was sold to them, and that you were somehow complicit in that decision. Am I simplifying that too much?
No, I don't think you're simplifying it too much. I think that is kind of the rub. I think the real point is this. You know, I think Dan, understandably, because he's an outsider, not an insider, has probably a fundamental misunderstanding about what the ownership approval process is about. You have to think through the timing of that process, right? You're talking about a group that has not had the advantage of being inside the organization, studying the talent. All they really see is a document room that, you know, has numbers on a page and financial information, and that there are conversations back and forth about numbers and projections. But the real point of that process is to make sure that the group coming in has adequate financial resources to put a competitive product on the field over the long haul. And the Marlins group raised an amazing amount of equity, putting the Dodgers to one side, probably the most equity ever raised in a baseball sale, $900 million. They went in to the ownership role with a really strong balance sheet, including a very, very nine-figure, as a matter of fact, substantial cash position on their balance sheet. And the point that I was trying to make to Mr. Le Batard before he devolved into name-calling was that we don't tell and really don't inquire about how you're going to keep this player, that player, or the other player. Or, you know, is the payroll projection number a hard number, or could it be higher, or could it be lower? That's not our business. That's a business for owners to decide once they take control of the club. Our job is to make sure that the ownership group has the financial wherewithal to make baseball decisions based on baseball considerations, not based on a lack of resources, and we absolutely 100% fulfilled our role with the Marlins purchase.
We're talking with MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred on the Mike Lubica podcast. More with Rob in a minute, but first this from Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. Talking to Rob Manfred, the 10th Commissioner of Baseball. Again, it's not my intent to relitigate your interview with Dan. I've known you both a long time. But let me ask you a broader question, because this kind of interests me. Is the long-term sustainability of Major League Baseball in Florida a concern of yours?
Well, look, Florida does concern me. There's a lot of... there have been some developments in Florida that I understand are difficult for fans. But, you know, when you really look at the history, they've won two real championships in the last 20 years, right? It's defied the odds. I mean, it's better than you would expect based on the number of teams. There's lots of markets who would make that swap with the Marlins. Despite that fact, and I guess because of the other developments that I referred to, there has not been tremendous fan support in terms of attendance in South Florida. And we're really hopeful that the new ownership group, Bruce Sherman and Derek Jeter, can revitalize that market, because South Florida is really important to Major League Baseball going forward.
We're talking to Rob Manfred on the Mike Lubica podcast on the Gillette Hotline. I want to circle back to something we talked about briefly before. Has there ever been anything that was more challenging and more contentious in your professional life, including in your time since you've become commissioner, than being in the barrel on Biogenesis?
Wow. Mike, I got a lot of scars on my back. The 94 strike was not a lot of fun. I will tell you that.
There was that. Okay, yeah.
But Biogenesis was a very heated, contentious activity. I think that on our side, we felt that it was really important to demonstrate to our fans and to the press that in addition to a really good drug testing program, we were intent on supporting that testing program with aggressive investigative tactics designed to keep our sport clean. And, there was a lot at stake, and people involved on the other side and the Biogenesis side, took steps to try to prevent that investigation from being successful. And, it was really contentious as a result.
We're talking to Rob Manfred on the Mike Lubica podcast. Could a cynical person, even despite the labor peace that has gone on in this sport for over 20 years, think that any blowback from the union on pace of play could be the first small, I don't want to be pessimistic here, but the first small storm cloud in the distance?
Mike, honestly, jumping from they have not yet made an agreement on pace of play, and I pick my words carefully there, their record of good labor relations is falling apart. It's kind of like jumping from, I had a little tiff with my wife this morning and we're going to go directly to divorce.
Don't try that lawyer crap on. Go ahead.
Labor relations are a long-term relationship. You're going to have your ups and downs. We think we have a positive relationship with Tony Clark, whether we agree every day or not. And, you know, we're and I use that to cover both baseball and the MLBPA, going to continue to make good decisions that respect the interest of our fans, the most fundamental of which is keeping the game on a field.
At this point in baseball, and my you're a much more empirical thinker than I am. At this point in baseball, it seems like there are 6,000 free agents left unsigned. What do you make of that?
Oh, it's a combination of things that are happening out there. Some of it is, you know, the emergence of quantitative thinking in the game. You know, people are looking much, much harder at what happens to players at particular age points and whether long-term contracts make sense at those age points. Some of it's related to the particular players that are out there, this particular class. Some of it's related to the agent that has, you know, four or five of the top players in the class and you know, the way that he chooses to conduct his negotiations. And look, some of it's related to the issue you kind of started with in your opening. You know, when the Yankees have the kind of young talent that they have, it's not a surprise they're a little less active in the free agent market. And the same thing can be said about a lot of our traditional big spenders, the Yankees, the Cubs, the Dodgers, all have this great young talent, and it affects their decision-making with respect to the market. So, you know, I see this, you know, the unions always wanted a market, right, for free agents. You know, markets go both directions. Some are really hot, some are not so hot.
You know, it's funny. It leads me to another point that I wanted to get to. At this point in time, when you even hear free spenders like the Yankees being bound and determined not to pass the luxury tax threshold, you got to think to yourself, holy crap, that luxury tax is working.
Well, look, we negotiated what we negotiated in the belief that it would, in fact, work. Again, this is a very small sample size, and I think the Yankees' ability to take the position they have publicly in terms of getting down below the threshold, it's a lot easier for them to do that given the young talent they have, point one. And point two, you got to remember, this agreement is a complex agreement. The benefit of getting below the tax threshold for at least 1 year is substantial. Let's wait and see what they decide to do in year two.
I think I'm right about this. And I actually think that I've asked you about this in the past. According to my own research, which, you know, can be a little sketchy, I think only one $200 million payroll baseball team has ever won the World Series. I think it was the 2009 New York Yankees. If you look at all the teams that have won since, there hasn't been one who was spending more than $200 million on baseball players. Now, obviously, you know, that would have changed if the Dodgers had won, but it speaks to what's going on in this sport without a salary cap.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reflection. Again, this is the second time I've referred back to your opening. Clubs are winning with young talent. And, you know, there's a much greater attention paid to what segments of your career, of a player's career, do you get the maximum productivity? And, you know, even if you think about the Dodger club last year, well, it was actually a high payroll club. If you look at the players that actually were out there playing, as opposed to on the roster, but, you know, and being carried for payroll purposes, but not really contributing on a day-to-day basis, they were not a high payroll club. They were a very young club. And so, you know, this is a result. What you're seeing is in part a result of general managers coming to the realization that there's a lot of young talent out there. You get maximum productivity from them at a certain point in their career, and that happens to be a point in their career where they're relatively inexpensive.
When you look at what the Astros have done, and to me, the process there is both compelling and fascinating, Rob. We're talking to Rob Manfred, the Commissioner of Baseball, because, you know, they went through Philadelphia 76er like Payne for their fans and losing 100 games and not spending any money. And now at the other end of that, it have become a model franchise under Jim Crane and Jeff Lunau and AJ Hinch and all that stuff and all the young talent they have. And does that provide a template to other teams to think they can do it, but maybe not with people as smart as the Astros had in place?
Well, look, I mean, you know, there's no question in an industry like ours where there's only 30 actors, that when you see sort of a different approach that leads to success, everybody, you know, looks hard at it and says, why not me, right? I mean, that's sort of natural. And I do think that there are a lot of clubs thinking that, that the kind of strategies that Jim Crane, Jeff Lunau employed in Houston turned out pretty well for that club, and that it's the sort of model that can be replicated.
All right, let's talk about things that I love to talk about. And that I referenced this, obviously, at the start of the podcast. And that is the young talent in this game, which I believe is that there has never been a comparison to me in any time in my life loving baseball. I wrote a column yesterday, Rob, about Jose Altuve and how he didn't just come to the game from Venezuela, which has produced so many star baseball players, including Cabrera, but he came to this moment in the sport at 5'6". And to me, the enduring beauty of baseball is that you can have him be number one in the MVP voting and somebody who looks like a tight end in Aaron Judge 2 and another tight end win the MVP in the other league. You can have Randy Johnson at 6'11 be a Hall of Fame pitcher, but you can also have Whitey Ford. And Rob, I looked something up yesterday. Willie, Mickey, and Hank Aaron hit nearly 2,000 home runs in the big leagues. Mickey and Hank were 6 feet tall and Willie Mays was 5'11". And to me, of all the things to recommend this game, that there's no size requirements, it might be the best.
Look, I agree with that. You know, I think that, you know, we've worked really hard on youth participation, and I think two things that are real selling points for our game is, you know, it's a really safe game that you can embrace, and there's no particular physical size advantage. We got players all shapes and sizes, and that's a great thing for young people because you don't look at our players and say, gee, you know, I'm not going to be 6'11", therefore, you know, I'm going to be limited in terms of how far I go. I'll tell you, the other thing about Jose, I mean, he's a very, not only great on the field, he's a really engaging personality true professional in terms of how hard he works at his craft.
Rob, by the way, I told you I'm down in Florida right now, and I'm not too far away from the ballpark of the Palm Beaches. Were you aware when the decision was made that the Astros and Nationals were going to move there, that those two teams and that ballpark might have saved spring training baseball on the east coast of Florida?
Oh, we were paying very close attention to, you know, sort of the, if you'll bear with me, migratory patterns of our club.
that was extremely politically well put. Yes, congratulations.
Right. And you know, look, both Florida and Arizona are really important to us. We need a certain amount of balance. Arizona is not as challenging just because of the geography. Everybody's close together. We needed additional teams on the east coast of Florida in order to have enough teams to have proximate competition on a daily basis. So we were thrilled that the ballpark at Palm Beach just got built.
Rob, before I let you go today, and I probably lied about how long I was going to keep you, but you're used to that by now. All right. In your life, did you think you could follow the 2016 World Series with an even better World Series in 2017? Because I was thinking about it the other day. If you think of the two World Series as a piece, we went from Game 7 with the Cubs and the Indians to Game 2 with the Astros and the Dodgers, which people were calling one of the great World Series games of all time, except that like 5 days later, Rob, we were both there that night, we saw the greatest damn game of World Series baseball ever played in Game 5.
Yeah. I think the best thing I can tell you about this, Mike, is, you know, I went to see my 88-year-old father after the World Series, and we were talking about just, you know, how great it had been and everything. And, you know, he looked at me and he said, you know, you must have been born under the right sign to get 16 followed by 17. You know, there's no other explanation for it. It's just, you know, it is the game showing itself in the best possible way. And, you know, couple that with the fact that we had some of our great young stars obviously involved and key in both of those series. We couldn't ask for better for the game.
And by the way, in the middle of that World Series, you had to make a very tough decision. And I told you at the time that I thought you made a just one. And it was about Yuri Gurriel. And what I couldn't understand at the time, and I still don't understand, is let's say that you had come to a determination that the best thing to do for him making that sign over at the other dugout would be to suspend him on the spot. Well, there's no way that it would have been appealed, and he would have continued to play. And your solution was to suspend him for the start of the season, because a suspension in the moment, to me, I mean, it would have sounded tough, but it would have done no practical good.
Well, look, revisiting what was a difficult decision, all I'll say to you is, there's a lot of legal overlay to what actually can happen there. And, you know, we tried to make a decision that was sensitive to the concerns of a community that was really, really important to us on the one hand, and recognize the realities of where we were from a legal perspective on the other.
When you, okay, I've got a couple more minutes, and let me just ask you this, okay? How resistant are you to the notion that... we hear this about all commissioners, okay? And as much power as there is that comes with the job, and there must be a lot of days when you think, I'm not nearly as powerful as people think I am, is that you ultimately are just an employee of the owners.
Well, look, the fact of the matter is that the commissioner is elected by the owners. You represent that constituency. But it's a little different than being an employee, particularly in our governance structure. You know, it takes 3/4 of the owners to elect you, right? It only takes a majority to reelect you. You do have a significant degree of independence from them.
If you had one magic bullet right now, Rob Manfred, for the 10th Commissioner of Baseball, the Mike Lubega podcast, and you could say, if I do this, I'll get this result. Would it be an average of 2.5-hour baseball games?
Yeah, look, I do believe that a 2.5-hour baseball game would be a good thing for the sport, a really, really important thing for the sport.
Things you didn't know about being in that chair and things you've learned in the last 3 years.
You know, I think that the single thing, and, you know, this is surprising given how long I was around, everything you say, particularly about the play of the game on the field, it attracts an extraordinary amount of attention. And you have to be really careful and thoughtful about the comments that you make, because people are so attracted and attached to the game that you can really evoke a lot of passion. The second thing, you know, it is different. Working in the game, you really are, you know, all the other jobs I've had, you really are an employer, a service provider. Once you become the commissioner, as we just talked about a second ago, there's a real political aspect to this job that's important to pay attention to.
Last question for Rob Manfred, who somehow continues to function well in this job without, you know, taking nearly as many of my own suggestions about improving the game as I would like him to. To me, the thing that ought to make baseball the envy of all the other big sports, Rob, and we talked about this before, the unbelievable geographic distribution of good teams. you have the Washington area in play. You got New York in play. You got Chicago in play. You got the Midwest in play, especially with the Indians. You got Texas in play, and you got California and the West Coast in play. That to me is a geography and that any of the other major sports would kill for.
Look, this one, hats off to Bud Selig. You know, people talk about Bud's legacy and, you know, why he was, elected to the Hall of Fame the first time that he was up. I mean, the man woke up in the morning and said competitive balance. And the last word he said before he went to sleep at night was competitive balance. And, you know, he did truly, revolutionize the game in a way that gave you that competitiveness all across the United States, and it's a tremendous asset for our sport.
All right, I promise this is the last question. Is there anything that has happened in 3 years on which you would like a do-over?
Oh, yes, there are so many things.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was the end of the interview. Would this beget another 40 minutes?
Can I tell you something? Yeah, of course there are. There are things that I have not done as well. As I wish I would have in retrospect. I try to pay attention to those things where I think that I haven't performed as well as possible in the hope that I do them better in the future, because I do take really, really seriously the enormous responsibility that comes along with this job. And believe me, I am humble enough to understand that each and everything I do is not exactly correct.
Hey, man, I wish you all the best in this job and in this sport. And thank you for doing this today. And go get on your flight to Washington.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
Rob Manfred, the 10th commissioner of baseball. Right before him on this podcast, we had Jack Nicklaus. Now the 10th commissioner of baseball. I tell you this every week. There is nothing more fun for me than doing this podcast, because I get to talk to people that I want to talk to. And I have these conversations with people that I feel that you want to hear from. So please continue to download the Mike Lupica podcast. Please subscribe to it. Go to the reader's comment. If I forgot something to ask them, tell me about it. And I'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.